I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation with a psychologist who says affluent teens are as troubled as their peers in poverty. It's just harder to see. But first, a commission of retired senior U.S. military and police officers recommended today that the U.S. lighten its footprint in Iraq.
The force footprint should be adjusted, in our view, to represent an expeditionary capability and to combat the permanent force image of today's presence. This will make an ultimate eventual departure much easier.
That's retired U.S. Marine General James Jones speaking earlier today to the Senate Armed Forces Committee. He headed the panel charged by Congress to study the Iraqi security forces. In his testimony today, he noted that some progress has been made, but it is uneven, giving a passing grade to the Iraq Army. But this is what General Jones had to say about the Iraqi police force.
The commission has recommended disbanding and reorganizing the national police, which is judged to be overly sectarian, composed 85% of Shia policemen, heavy-handed in their mission execution, not trusted by people of other ethnic origins. There are allegations of corruption that pervade this force as well.
Dimitri Sevastopoulos is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. He joins us. And Dimitri, much of the view of the Army and police had been leaked in advance, but what do you make of the panel's recommendation to lighten the U.S. footprint?
It's extremely interesting, and the reason is that's exactly what General Casey, who was the former CENTCOM commander in the Middle East, and the former head of U.S. forces in Iraq, and General Abizaid, the former CENTCOM commander, had been arguing before they left. But instead, President Bush decided to accept a recommendation to implement a surge, which General Petraeus is now doing. So General Jones is essentially taking the view that many of the top commanders in U.S. military previously wanted before the surge.
So that U.S. forces wouldn't be seen as occupiers?
That they wouldn't be seen as occupiers, and also that by starting to withdraw forces slowly and reduce the U.S. presence, you would also put more pressure on the Iraqi government to start implementing some of the political reconciliation that most people say is crucial for long-term stability in Iraq.
What else stood out for you today?
I think it was interesting that he said there was uneven progress in the Iraqi security forces. You remember the whole reason this commission was set up was pushed for by John Warner, the Republican senator, because congressmen and women were tired of seeing charts from the Pentagon showing the actual numbers of Iraqi soldiers that were standing in uniform. President Bush used to always say, as they stand up, we will stand down. But when it came to combat situations, the Iraqi security forces performed very badly. So Congress wanted an independent evaluation. General Jones said there's been uneven progress. He said the Iraqi security forces will be unable to function independently in the next 12 to 18 months. He doesn't talk about what happens after that. That wasn't his mandate. And he says they will not be able to secure the borders against conventional military threats in the near term. So while the forces have improved overall over time, there's still a lot to be done. And it raises questions as to whether if the U.S. withdraws forces over the next year and a half, what will be the implication for the Iraqi security forces? And really, can they really take over after that?
This was a commission and a panel that was required by Senator Warner, who wanted an independent assessment. We also got the GAO report earlier this week, and that was on benchmarks. And we've been asking the question of observers such as yourself, whether or not all of these reports, we're expecting another one on Monday from General Petraeus, whether they matter in a certain sense, or is there a feeling that there is an inexorable march towards a longer stay in Iraq, and these reports really don't matter?
I think they do and they don't. They do matter because they feed into the arguments on Capitol Hill, and if they're overwhelmingly negative, it will put more pressure on Republicans who are thinking about the 2008 elections to put more pressure on President Bush. They don't matter in the sense that ultimately President Bush has the last word and he can do what he wants. I was with Secretary Gates and President Bush in Anbar earlier this week, and they talked about the improved security, yet we were in a very heavily fortified base, and aside from a few Iraqi politicians, we didn't see a single Iraqi the whole day. So the situation is still very fluid, but I think Congress is going to be the focus next week. How do Republican senators and congressmen respond to President Bush and to these reports?
Dimitri Sevastopoulos, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Dimitri, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin. Bye.
Well, switching gears now, as teenagers, specifically affluent teens, head back to school, are they carrying baggage not visible in their backpacks? It seems counterintuitive, but you might remember when Dr. Sunia Luthar was a guest on the program. She's a professor of psychology and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. Her research showed that by the time affluent kids reached adolescence, they're 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety, far more likely to use alcohol and drugs, far more likely to engage in risky behaviors like cutting, than their lower-income peers. Madeline Levine, a practicing psychologist, would agree. She's been seeing troubled teens for 25 years. Her book, The Price of Privilege, How Parental Pressure and Material Advantage Are Creating a Generation of Disconnected and Unhappy Kids, gathers her experience and shows how families can address the problems of their teenagers. Welcome.
In The Price of Privilege, I sort of opened the book by talking about this young girl who had come into the office with what I call the typical cutter disguise, which is always a long sleeve T-shirt with a hole for the thumb so that they hide their wrists where a lot of the cutting takes place. And when we chatted and I finally got her to pull up the T-shirt sleeve, she had incised the word empty into her arm. And, you know, in what psychologists are fond of calling an aha moment, I realized that she had captured the dilemma of what felt like a fairly recent phenomena of kids that I were seeing in my office.
And what was that? That they were empty?
I've been practicing for 25 years, Robin, and I'm used to seeing upset, distraught, depressed, unhappy kids. For most of that time, those kids looked unhappy. They came in, they were frazzled, they were doing poorly in school. It wasn't hard to tell that they were having psychological problems.
These are the kids who had clear eating disorders, junior high school girls that you write who were regularly giving oral sex to boys but saying they weren't sexually active. As you write, an astonishing redefinition of sexual activity. It was clear that they had problems, but this new group that you're talking about, you couldn't look at them and see these problems.
That's right. And that's why the metaphor of empty hidden by the shirts, you know, sort of encapsulated what I was seeing. And that is kids with an astounding capacity to present a good front. They don't look frazzled. They drive up in good cars. They're made up. Often their grades are being maintained. They may be the captain of the basketball team or a cheerleader. But when you scratch the surface, when you pull up that sleeve, what you find are kids who are very troubled, have very high rates of depression and anxiety disorders and substance abuse, but you can't tell it from the surface.
How is this different in your, you know, having treated teenagers from the usual angst-ridden, you know, sort of glazed-eyed, at least to any adult, teenager?
There's a huge difference between a quote, normal adolescent who's struggling with issues of identity and what they're going to do with their life, and the teenagers that I'm talking about who are either up in their room cutting themselves, terribly depressed, suicidal, dealing drugs, things like that.
Right. Tell us more about these teenagers that you are talking about who appear so successful, as you write. They just seem to lack a sort of awareness about the world. You write, they complain about being bored, and they are often boring.
Well, you know, I believe that what has happened to many of these kids is that the development of a sense of self, the sort of building blocks of healthy psychological development, have basically been stopped in their tracks. So in addition to being often very immature, these kids lack the kind of robust, enthusiastic, developing sense of self one would expect in adolescence. And by empty, I think what I'm talking about is a lack of enthusiasm for who they are, a very, very small toolbox of self-management skills, which is a huge issue because as the self develops, and by the self, you know, I mean an inner life, I mean interest in the world, I mean connection with people, I mean the ability to be good at something, the ability to feel like a separate person, autonomy and competence and connection and self-management skills.
Well, as you write, these kids have been inadvertently deprived of an opportunity to develop an inside. How?
Right.
Is it just the parents?
This is not just about parents. We live in a culture of affluence, and that culture of affluence values material things over real connection. It values competition over reciprocity. It values individuality over the community. So we have, you know, sort of the social ocean that we're all swimming in, and we do have parents who are incredibly anxious about their child's progression through life and their child's ability to maintain the kind of social and financial standing that their parents have. And so the process by which a self is developed, and that has a lot to do with leaving a psychological space for kids to hang out, to think about who they are, to learn how to fall down and pick themselves up, is all being impeded by well-meaning parents who step in way too easily. I'm going to give you an example just to make it real. I had two kids in my practice who are in the same grade, and they both had a paper due, and the electricity went out in my community. And they were kids. They hadn't saved their work. They lost their paper. One of those kids then stayed up the entire night rewriting his paper. The other kid's mom stayed up the entire night rewriting that paper. And when the parent steps in a situation like that, they deprive the child of the opportunity to learn something about themselves. I can do this, to learn what it is they need to do, self-management tool of putting off gratification, can't sleep until my work is done. It's all well-intended, but it gets right in the way of the heart of what kids need to develop, which is a sense that they can manage out in the world without their parents' constant intervention.
But, you know, that's a paper. You know, I can hear a parent saying, but the stakes are so much higher than that. I have to step in and help my kids because there's drugs, there's, you know, early choices about sex, there's, you know, they got to get into the right college. And there's so much more at stake.
I think you're absolutely right when you say parents have to help their children. And we know that an involved parent is optimal for child development. I think what's happened is we've sort of lost our sense of what help actually means. And of course, that changes over the course of child development. But we're talking about teenagers. So is help pushing constantly? Is help demanding constantly? Is help criticizing regularly? Or does help really take a different form? I'd argue that in adolescence, help for an adolescent has a lot to do with involvement, not over-involvement, which I don't think it's all that damaging. What is terribly damaging is intrusion, and that's getting into the child's psychological space with guilt or shame, saying, you know, every man in this family has gone to Princeton. If you don't go there, you're going to be flipping burgers for the rest of your life.
Madeline Levine, a practicing psychologist based in California who's researched children from affluent families. After the break, we want to ask, how can you compare an affluent child with one in poverty or an affluent family with families in other kinds of stress, which reminds us, later in the program, a mother whose son was killed in Iraq. Back with all of this after a break. Quick break, here and now. We're talking about troubled teens with Madeline Levine, a practicing psychologist and author of The Price of Privilege, How Parental Pressure and Material Advantage Are Creating a Generation of Disconnected and Unhappy Kids. Dr. Levine, before the break, we were talking about what sounds like what's being called, you know, helicopter parents who hover and do things for kids. You also talked about shame and teens. And I'm wondering, whose shame are you talking about? You know, the parent or the child? And is that maybe part of the problem?
As soon as you hear I too much in a conversation, I'm so ashamed of you, or I looked over your work and I just can't believe you handed that kind of garbage in, you know you've inserted too much of yourself. Now that, and I want to be really clear about this point, because it's not in any way a call for disengagement. As a matter of fact, what we know about upper middle class kids is they feel terribly disconnected from their parents anyway. Mm. I'm not talking about disengagement. I'm not talking about disconnection. I'm not saying, you know, go and do the best you can and let the chips fall where they may. a parent absolutely should be involved, but they need to be involved in an age-appropriate way. And for adolescents, that means that the goal is autonomy, not dependency. And how do you get that? You get that by allowing kids to experience the world as long as they're safe, and letting them learn how to navigate around problems.
I want to reinforce that this is not, as you said, about parents are just bad. You write, most of my patients are deeply troubled, not spoiled. Most of their parents are not narcissistic, but struggling, often alone, another factor, with their own problems. The suffering they both feel is genuine and not trivial. How do you explain to someone who is low income and trying to keep their kids from being, you know, shot, that this idea of teenagers being, you know, empty is that big a problem?
I had an interesting conversation with somebody who works with foster kids, and these are kids who have gone from family to family in the system. And they set up a trial program bringing in affluent kids in with these kids who had basically lived in poverty all their life with a great deal of anxiety, thinking that the poorer kids would just blow off the rich kids. But in fact, that didn't happen. They acknowledged, recognized, and understood that their problems actually were incredibly similar, that they felt alone. And, that, you know, we don't disregard a middle-class kid who's suffering because a kid in poverty is suffering, and we don't disregard the kid in poverty because there are kids in Darfur having unimaginable trauma. A suffering child is a suffering child. And, you know, you raise the point about parents suffering as well as the kids. I think the exact same pressures that are on upper middle class kids are on their parents. You know, intense pressure to look good, not good, outstanding. Good is sort of tantamount to failure in many of these places. To always be perfect, to go it alone, are the exact same problems that the mothers are experiencing. If Caitlin is having trouble in math and you call a neighbor and say, I just, you know, I'm really, really worried about Caitlin. She's getting C's. She doesn't seem to be getting it. And the neighbor's response is, well, Johnny gets straight A's. I don't know what Caitlin's problem is. If you expose yourself, if you allow yourself to be vulnerable and are met with aggression as opposed to compassion, you close down. And I think that there's a tremendous amount of competition for the kids, but also for the parents in these communities. And as a result, they feel incredibly isolated.
Many of the parents, by the way, who, again, you remark, are single, are turning to their children to make up for some of the connections missing in their adult relationships. And so it doesn't feel, it may be close, but it's not the relationship a child needs from a parent.
I think it's married parents as well as single parents. I think that for many upper middle class women, their best emotional bet feels like their children. Their husbands are often busy, preoccupied with work, and they don't feel close in their community. They've often moved around a lot. The competition is great. Their kids are a place that they turn to for emotional support.
Madeline Levine, a practicing psychologist. She's been seeing troubled teens for 25 years. By the way, just share with us, as a parent and a psychologist, what's one thing that you did to break this in your own family, one thing you did with your teens?
I have a story in the book which I say is my worst parenting moment ever, and it really was when my youngest son, A- in language arts, slipped to a B+, and I just lit into him, and the kid's laying in bed and crying, and it, you know, it hits me that I'm writing a book about what a terrible idea it is to berate children when they've tried, when they've put out effort for their grades. And so I sort of left the room, composed myself, thought about what it was that I was so incredibly anxious about. And in my particular case, realized I came from a very working class background. I lost my father when I was young. And verbal skills were my way out. And so the fact that my younger kids' verbal skills weren't as good as I had wished they might be was what set me off. And I think what I learned from that and put into practice was, when I have a visceral reaction that's critical, to step out of the room and really examine whether that's coming from the present or whether that's part of my own history that I'm inserting into the present. I think that's an important thing. We all carry what Selma Freiberg called ghosts in the nursery, you know, the ways in which our past impacts our present. And I think when you start getting really agitated about something around your kids' grades or performance, it really helps to step back and say, how did this work in my own life? Where is this coming from? So I've become very attuned to that.
Dr. Levine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Madeline Levine, a practicing psychologist in Northern California, author of the book The Price of Privilege, How Parental Pressure and Material Advantage Are Creating a Generation of Disconnected and Unhappy Kids. Well, this program note, Dr. Levine talked a bit about parents who hover over their kids, and one case doing a homework assignment. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to look at these so-called helicopter parents. College officials know them all too well. They've been known to pick their kids' classes, call a professor to argue about a grade. Many parents have been called into auditoriums across the country this week as colleges address the problem. We'll attend one session at one college here in Boston. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the history of the modern world in cartoons and Pavarotti's signature song in full. That's after the news, Here and Now. Our top story today, a panel of retired military officials told Congress that the U.S. should lighten its footprint in Iraq, but they also conclude that Iraqi forces will not be capable of taking control of the country for at least a year and a half. Well, it's one of several reports due this month, none of which will change our next guest's story. Today, we have another in our series of occasional conversations with moms whose sons have died in the war. As of today, the Department of Defense says 3,742 members of the American military have been killed in the war in Iraq. One of those soldiers was Army Specialist Nicholas Eugene Wilson of Glendale, Arizona. He died in a Humvee accident in Ramadi on March 11, 2005. He was 21. His mom is Debbie Newhouse. She is a fourth-grade teacher in Glendale. She spoke recently with Here Now's Alex Ashlock.
Nick was my only son. We had just seen him, which was fortunate. You know, I think anybody who has to go through the nightmare of losing a child, every day brings different challenges. I have good days. I have not-so-good days.
What do you do on those not-so-good days?
I cry. I do a lot of writing. I eventually would like to write some books to help people that are in this situation, to because there's nothing out there for specifically dealing with the military death of a young person. I'd like to do some writing on for elementary students so that they can get more of a grasp of reality. I do a lot of yard work. I do a lot of walking. I've got a few, you know, supportive friends that I know that I can talk to. But basically, I think I cry, and it's a lot of alone time. So,
the students you had when Nick died in Iraq, they knew him, right? They knew who he was, and he had written letters to them. Is that correct?
He did some beautiful letters home to the kids, and a lot of them have said that they have framed Nick's his last letter that he sent us.
I don't know if this is the last letter that he sent, but I read this in another obituary that I had seen, and he wrote to the students, "Life is whatever you have, wherever you are. You have to remember you make it what you want it to be. You have to have faith, confidence, positive outlook, and always be open to do things in a different, faster, and smarter way."
Yep, that was his last letter to them. In fact, one of the Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts meetings, they had read that to inspire some of the little boys. And they asked my permission for that, and I said, absolutely, Nick would want that. And he was that way. He was always, he was your non-traditional learner, let's say.
I have a couple of kids like that.
I have a lot every year, I think.
Now, the kids you have today in 2007, obviously they didn't know Nick.
Correct.
Do they know that he was killed in Iraq?
Since school has just begun, I did an opening letter to the parents to let them know, and I do have pictures of Nick and Becca in my classroom. Becca's my daughter. And I think for students, though, I think for, because I'm dealing with a lot of nine and 10-year-olds, I think a lot of times it just simply doesn't register what that concept of death and losing someone looks like, because they haven't had to deal with it. And those are the kind of books that I want to, I would like to write to help facilitate kids.
You said earlier that you had seen Nick not long before he died. He had come home on leave.
Yes.
Tell me about that visit.
When he got here, he was like, I knew he was my son, but he was like a different person because of how he was behaving. He was scared going in traffic. He would roll down the windows. He would be yelling at people. When we got into public places, he would crouch real low so as not to be seen. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, you never know if the enemy's around the corner, Mom. But as far as like his sleep patterns when he got back, he couldn't sleep. He was used to doing what he did in Iraq, in our Ramadi. And he'd sleep about an hour and a half, and then go out. He'd rent a car, and he'd go out, and he'd peruse the neighborhoods, and I'd see him before I'd go to work and go, what were you doing? And he's like, well, I was just patrolling Phoenix, Mom. Everything's safe.
So he'd been up all night?
He'd been up all night. When he got here, of course, he didn't have any of his weapons, so he went out right away, and he bought 3 knives, a Glock, and a rifle. And he had that with him all the time.
It must have been very difficult for you to let him go back.
Yep.
I mean, you said he looked like your son, but from what you're describing, this behavior was nothing like the son you had sent off to war.
Not at all. I know he was scared. I know he talked to my my husband, his stepdad, about how he was scared. He had a bad feeling about going back. Both Ray and I reassured him that you just go back, you do the best you can, and then you come home. He only had 8 more months left to do. So he was brave, and he went back.
Debbie, thanks so much for talking to me.
You're welcome. And here's the cat. This is Nick would call from Iraq. First thing he'd want to do was to talk to this cat.
And it sounds like the cat would talk back.
Yes, the cat would talk back. And then he would tell me, he goes, Mom, I know it's going to be a good day because I got to talk to Manu.
And we did too.
Yes.
Debbie, thanks again.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's Debbie Newhouse of Glendale, Arizona. Her son, Army Specialist Nicholas Eugene Wilson, was killed in Ramadi on March 11, 2005. She spoke with Here Now's Alex Ashlock. And again today, a panel of retired senior military and police officers said the U.S. should lighten its footprint in Iraq so as not to appear as occupiers. The panel also said the mission of U.S. troops in Iraq could be adjusted as early as next year to allow the Iraqi army to assume more control of daily combat. One retired Marine Corps general has told the panel that the adjustment would make an eventual departure much easier. This Monday, the highly anticipated report from General David Petraeus, head of U.S. forces in Iraq. He'll report on progress in the war. You're listening to Here and Now.
Maria.
Luciano Pavarotti, the son of a singing baker who became one of opera's best-known maestros, died this morning at his home in Modena, Italy, after a year-long battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 71. Alex Ross writes about classical music for the New Yorker magazine and on his blog, The Rest is Noise. Alex, this is an artist that, you know, everyone felt that they knew. What is it about his voice that might have touched people? I've heard it called plaintive.
Well, I think it was this naturalness, this effortlessness. I think the very finest singers are those who not only get all the notes across, but he also got across the words, the phrases. I think singing is most thrilling when it becomes a kind of heightened talking.
Well, we felt today as the eulogies have poured in, of course, cheated, with his loss, but also teased by the snippets of music we've heard. You know, we wanted to hear more. So we want to do that. We want to play a piece in full. It's the 3-minute Nessun Dorma from Puccini's Turandot. It's Pavarotti's version from the Three Tenors in Concert CD. Would you just tell us what we're about to hear?
The joy of communication. I think the whole Three Tenors thing and everything that followed was about Pavarotti discovering this really direct connection with a huge public. And even if it wasn't quite opera as theater, where for me it's most powerful, it's very potent stuff.
Alex Ross, classical music critic of The New Yorker. Luciano Pavarotti died this morning at 71, and we're now reminded of what we've lost. Cartoonist Larry Gonick was an underground cult favorite until the late Jacqueline Onassis edited his Cartoon History of the Universe, and he became an above-ground cult favorite. His new Cartoon History of the Modern World picks up where History of the Universe leaves off, providing a wickedly funny take on history from the Aztec Empire through Europe and Asia, culminating in the American Revolution. And somehow, no matter what country, everyone sounds like a world-weary guy behind a deli counter in Brooklyn. Kings, queens, Incas, Mayans, explorers of the sea and the sky, popes, reformers, they're all there in all their messy glory.
America's first people arrived 12, 15, or 30,000 years ago by land or sea from Siberia or somewhere else. They killed all the mastodons, ground sloths, and saber-toothed tigers, or else the big animals died of climate change. That much is almost certain.
That's Larry Gonick reading from his book, The Cartoon History of the Modern World, Part 1, and he joins us from his native San Francisco. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be here.
You know, I was surprised to learn that you were born and raised in San Francisco, because I read this as if, well, you were some guy behind a deli counter in New York, because that's how everyone from history sounded. You have Indians saying, that'll do the trick, and queens telling kings to shut up.
I think Calvin even tells God to shut up.
I think so. That maybe that's what it is. Describe for those who aren't in the huge numbers of college students for whom you are now a god, what the tone that you're going for is.
Maybe we can start with a quote from Gibbon about what history is.
Okay.
He says, history is the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. And I say, thank God for the follies. There's a satirical take. It's like a vast political cartoon where the politics is happening in the past. And the misfortunes can be funny, too. Another quote would be from Mel Brooks, who said, comedy is when you fall down a manhole, and tragedy is when I have a hangnail.
Pretty big darn manholes here, as whole peoples are wiped out, you know, across the history of time. You also show us that, well, maybe one people, and I'm thinking of the people who originally lived in what is now Mexico,
mm-hmm.
maybe they would rip the heart out of living persons in some sort of a ritual. But who, boy, with the explorers then did who came and took them over?
It's true. There have been mass exterminations And those I try not to play for comedy. When you say the people of Mexico, of course, we're talking about the people who ran the empire. The Aztecs were not sweet people, and they had many bitter enemies in Mexico, and it was the alliances with those people that allowed the Spaniards to conquer them.
And as you write, a fresh disaster greeted them. Smallpox spreads throughout the area. And you write, imagine a disease that blisters and then kills you. Imagine it carries off most of your friends and family. Imagine the Tlaxcalans, the natives.
Tlaxcalans, right. Tlaxcalans. They were the friends of the Spaniards,
right.
or allies of the
right.
Spaniards. Right.
Imagine their panic and despair, and yet they stood by the Spaniards and sheltered them. That's, you know, pretty powerful comic.
It is, and the image, of course, is not done in a comic style. You know, the style of this is sort of old-fashioned comic burlesque. People have goggle eyes and so on. It's cartoony.
Mm.
I do that because I think it actually humanizes people and allows you to sort of ease into the material more easily. If it was drawn in the style of Spider-Man, it wouldn't work as well.
This is very powerful. I mean, these, you know, see these natives weeping over this illness. But then in the very next frame, you have one of your, they're called footnotes. You see a foot
yes.
holding a note.
Yes.
You show historians, and now this frame is in current time.
Right.
You say historians like the idea that disease caused most native deaths, and you have the historians saying, gosh, our ancestors didn't mean to kill so many people. Yeah, they hardly shot or stabbed or starved more than a few million.
Exactly.
Another, I feel strangely relieved.
Yes. One thing to note there is, you know, that all history is written with an eye to sort of arguing with or satirizing or making fun of the other historians, you know, who are writing at the same time. So some of the satire or barbs, you know, will be addressed at other points of view there now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, history isn't just about what happened in the past. It's what people say about it.
It's also a reminder that one man's or one country's explorer is another country's, you know, destroyer. With that in mind, I just wanted to tick through some of the things, many of which we felt we were reading for the first time or hearing for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, are they true? For instance, did Spanish explorer Cortez murder his wife because she sort of got in the way of his having concubines in conquered Mexico?
Well, it wasn't that it got in the way of his having concubines. It was that she got in the way of his having a noble wife, you know, because he thought he was considerably better than she was. the verdict isn't in, but she died after an argument. In the morning, they found bruises on her throat, you know, but the official inquest put it down as asthma. But it's very much an open question. Huh. There were certainly people who thought he did it.
Well, is there really a Filipino who's
a minor?
Yeah. Okay, well.
He's got his own website, Enrique Malacca, first person to circumnavigate the globe. He was the servant of Magellan. He was born in the Philippines. He was sent off to some slave market in Borneo or someplace, you know, Sumatra probably. Magellan was serving with the Portuguese in Asia. He bought him, took him back to Portugal and went to Spain, and then took him on the trip, right? And they went all the way around. When they got to the Philippines and Magellan was killed, Enrique got off.
As you write, the explorers reached the Philippines where Magellan, half unhinged, walked into a fatal hail of arrows. I shouldn't laugh.
Yeah.
Forward, men, no panic, you picture him saying. Your leader is here, as he shouts out. And then this Filipino jumps off ship, or as you show him running into the arms of his dad. Dad, have I got a story to tell you?
He was the first.
Well, there's him. There's William of Orange, a man who, as you write, founded a nation, the United Provinces of the Netherlands, barely in the history books.
I think the reason we don't hear more about William of Orange is that the United States likes to think we invented it. It, that is, sort of a federated country where people could practice their, you know, there was freedom of religion and freedom of the press and so on. That was the Netherlands, and it was called the United Provinces of the Netherlands. And when the United States was formed, they had that model in mind. They called it the United States of America. It's a conscious echo of the Netherlands. And William of Orange is the founder of this thing, a very rare nation founder, you know, in history, who's self-effacing. When they won the Great Battle of Leiden, he built a university to commemorate it, not a statue of himself.
The history of the Revolution in America is this thin, thin portion in the back of the book. By the time they get to that, you think, well, we're so nothing.
But that's so not true, actually. I hope it comes plain in the next, part two of the Cartoon History of the Modern World that I'm working on now. This was, an enormously significant event.
Obviously.
What is true is that customary historical treatments leave out the international perspective. You know, by doing all this stuff about Spain and France, I was able to make it clear what was going on in Canada. Canada was founded before Massachusetts.
Oh, don't get me started on the beaver pelts. That's a whole other story. I'm realizing we're starting to talk like, again, the characters in your book. Did you ever worry about making it too flip? You have King saying, it's heretic clobbering time, and priest saying, thou shalt not kill is such an outmoded concept. Did you ever worry about it being too flip?
I worry about everything, but that doesn't stop me. What can I say? I'm a worrier. Cartoonists are like that, We just get down behind our drawing board and we never know what's next.
What do you hear, Larry Gonick, from college campuses? Are you aware of how big a hit you are with college students? This has sort of become the fun cliff notes of American history.
I get very little hostile email, let's put it that way. I hear from students and I hear from teachers, actually all over the world. I just had a little flurry of emails from Indonesia. I didn't know why, and then the day before yesterday, a package of Indonesian translations landed on my desk.
Oh, I'd give anything to know how they translate, it's heretic clobbering time.
Oh, I'm sure they've got words for that. It's a Muslim nation. The interesting thing to me was that many of these correspondents identify themselves as Muslims, but like it anyway. Everybody gets an equally hard time, to put it that way.
Larry Gonick's book is The Cartoon History of the World, Part 1, From Columbus to the U.S. Constitution. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.